Herzlich willkommen in meinem Podcast Vivace, lebe deine Berufung, liebe dich selbst. Heute habe ich ein ganz besonderes Interview für dich. Ich durfte nämlich mit dem Glücksforscher Randall Birnberg sprechen. Und Randall ist in den USA aufgewachsen und hatte eine sehr schwere Kindheit mit allem, was man sich so vorstellen kann, was an traumatischen Erfahrungen so passieren kann, von Gewalt, sexuellem Missbrauch, Drogenkonsum, finanziellen Mangel, und er berichtet, wie er es über die Jahre geschafft hat, diese Wunden zu heilen und seine Glaubenssätze umzuprogrammieren, und beschäftigt sich heute intensiv mit dem Thema positive Psychologie und was Menschen brauchen, um glücklich zu sein. Und er teilt ganz viele seiner Tipps und Tricks mit dir in dieser Folge. Und ja, das Interview ist wirklich vollgepackt mit Informationen und Inspirationen, und ich hoffe, es ist einiges für dich dabei. Lass mich gern wissen, wie dir die Folge gefallen hat. Du kannst mir dazu gerne eine Mail schreiben oder über Instagram. Du findest die Kontaktdaten wie immer in den Shownotes. Und wie immer freue ich mich auch riesig über eine Bewertung, vor allen Dingen auf iTunes, damit möglichst viele Menschen diese Inspiration auch bekommen können. Ich wünsche dir einen wunderschönen Tag und jetzt erstmal viel Freude beim Zuhören. Welcome, Randall, to my podcast. I'm very happy to have you here today. And I know you work on happiness in the first place. So you do research on that, and you are a coach, a speaker and trainer in the region, but also internationally. And I would love you to introduce yourself a little more into detail, if you would like.
Okay. Well, first, thank you, Lillian, for this, for having me here. I appreciate you wanting to know more about my story and knowing about other people's stories, because we're it's all about stories at the end. It's about our personal stories. So let me give a quick background of of my personal story. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, 1962. I was born. You do the math. I basically grew up in a family of restaurants people. My grandfather was an Italian from Palermo. Moved to America in the 20s, eventually got hooked up with some people back then who happened to be gangsters. And I basically grew up in a very Italian, in an Italian neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, and in a gangster kind of situation. I saw things which eventually helped me find happiness. I saw things that I had to talk about in therapy, you know, years later. My grandfather was the kingpin. He was the head of the family, and he basically did things to my mother that weren't very nice. He did good things too. I mean, he provided for the family with the restaurants and all that. But the good things we take along with us, as well as the bad things. So he did some, just a little background. He kind of was a little abusive to my mom. And what parents tend to do, unless they become aware of it not being the right thing to do, they generally pass things down the line, you know. And she basically physically abused me. She would hit me. So, that went on. And anyway, I went to school, grammar school. I worked in the restaurant business. I used to open the restaurant with my grandmother in the mornings, and then I would go off to school. So I really grew up in the service industry, which is part of who I am, you know, and it's part of who we all are, which I've come to believe is that we're all on this planet for a reason, and that reason is to give some kind of service, period. The hard part is, what service is that for people? People don't know how to get to that service, which I'm going to try to get the people listening to this podcast to possibly get to what could be their service. So anyway, so I grew up in this environment, very abusive environment, but this taught me many, many things, you know. I ended up going to college, 18 years old. I started Loyola University in Chicago. And at that time, I was dating an Italian woman, like a real Italian woman, not an American Italian, an Italian Italian. And I got caught up in this whole, like, Italian thing. you know, when I was younger, yeah, okay, my grandfather was Italian, but I tried to stay away from him because he wasn't the most kind guy. But when I started dating, I said, wow, this Italian thing seems really cool. So I ended up going to a college that had a sister school in Rome. And I thought one day I would go to Rome and go to school. So this was my intention, my vision when I was 18, 19 years old because of this woman. So I ended up going to college for my first couple of years. And then my junior year came around and I said, I went up to my uncle. My grandfather had passed away and my uncle had taken over the business, the family business, and he had lots of money. And I went up to my uncle and I said, Unc, you know, can you send me to Rome? I want to do my junior year of college at Loyola University. And he said, sure. And he said, sure, for a few reasons. I wrote a book about it, and my book is called Awfully Happy, if anyone's interested. And you can get it on Amazon. Just type in Awfully Happy. And it talks about my childhood being at times awful, what I grew up with. But in the end, I'm awfully happy. I kind of used the double meaning there. So anyway, my uncle ended up sending me to Rome. It was 1985. I left Chicago, Southside Chicago, Rome. Had never been out of the neighborhood. And suddenly I was in Europe and I was like loving it. In 1985, I landed in August. This is now this month, but you know, a while back. I was in heaven. I started learning Italian at Loyola University on Monte Mario. That's where Loyola is. Mm-hmm. I started learning Italian. I started learning about opera. We took a class called, you know, the history of opera and the elements of opera. I started learning about the topography of Rome, architecture, all this beautiful history that Rome had, the Romans, the Roman Empire, and at the same time, my uncle back in Chicago wanted my stay to be extra special. So he was sending me about $1,000 every week, week every 2 weeks for 9 months. I got $1,000. I used to go down to the Spanish Stairs because they had an American Express office there. And I would go in and get my $1,000 because he'd send it through American Express. And I was living big, as they say. You know, I got a Eurorail pass, first class Eurorail pass I had. So I was traveling all over Europe. I had a beautiful kind of a rich European lifestyle for those 9 months. I found myself at Oktoberfest. It was my first experience with Oktoberfest here in Germany. I don't remember much because I think I was drunk for 5 days there. But something like climbing out a window with one of those down comforters. I just remember something like that. But other than that, that's about it. Traveled a lot. I traveled with on the train with my Euro pass to Spain. Went down to Malaga, went over to Marbella, ended up taking a cruise from Malaga over to the islands, over to Genova. I was all over Europe. And when I came back in June of 1986, it was one school year. I said to myself, I had a vision. I said, I will be back. I will be back in this beautiful Europe to live. Came back to America, eventually graduated. I have a communications degree with an Italian minor. In America, we have a major and a minor, and with lots of psychology courses in there as well. At the same time, I started therapy. When I got back, I realized if you take yourself out of what's considered normal or what you grew up in, start to realize some interesting things about yourself. But sometimes you have to physically take yourself out of places and to look back and go, it changes the perspective. You look at your life through a window. Mm-hmm. And I really saw Chicago when I was staying in Rome in a different light. And I saw my family in a different light. And I saw all these things. So when I got back, I started therapy. I needed to make sense of what the hell happened in my childhood. And I would say one of my saving graces was therapy. I went in and it was once a month I started, and I just couldn't get enough therapy. I was just loving this stuff because I had some psychology classes and I knew about psychology. But you see, the Americans, you know, we turned psychology into therapy. Psychology wasn't necessarily therapy. Mm-hmm. But after the Second World War, soldiers came back and had something called post-traumatic stress syndrome. And with post-traumatic stress syndrome, this is where therapy kind of was initiated in the States. And I always say, you know, in America today, if you don't have a therapist, you're crazy, you know, because every third person has a therapist in the States. And if they don't have one now, they had one then when they were younger. So therapy is normal for us.
So it's just so anyway, makes sense to have a therapist.
Yeah, you know, you have to talk about, so I love therapy. And I, even my partner and I, when we can't come to terms on stuff, we need a neutral party. We go and see a third person to kind of go, okay, what do you need? What do you need? Did you hear what he needs? Did you hear what she needs? And we basically make sense of what we're needing.
Yeah.
And I really tell people in my courses and seminars, if you're in a relationship and you come up with a situation that you cannot solve, go to a third person. And that third person, you can call it a mediator, you can call it a counselor, you can call it whatever you want, but someone with some neutrality to mm-hmm. take a look at the situation. So when I got back in 86, and then 87 graduated, I didn't really know what to do with myself. So my uncle had some restaurants still back then, which where he made all his money. And I started waiting tables, didn't really know what to do. And then 1988, my brother, who had moved out to California, my oldest brother, I have three brothers, two older, one younger. And my oldest brother, he had always been my hero. He was my, whatever he did, he really, I admired him, you know, he's my oldest brother. The next one up, we were too close for me to admire him. We were always fighting for stuff. You know, we grew up fighting stuff. But the oldest one, for example, when I was 14 years old, he was at the university. He was at college. It was 1976. And he came home from college once. And whatever Bob did, that was me. I was like, I wanted to be like Bob. Rand wants to be like Bob. And I remember very, very, very vividly my brother coming home from college the summer of 1976 and saying to his younger brother, Rand, come on in the basement. I want to show you what I learned. And I went down to my mom's basement and he goes, yeah, pull up your sleeve. This is going to be great. Yeah, I pulled up my sleeve. He pulls out a spoon. He puts a piece of cotton in the spoon, puts some little white powder in there, puts a little water in there, lights it up, pulls out a needle. He grabs one of my mother's nylon socks because the downstairs in our basement, we had our wash machine. So with our nylon clothes there, ties my arm and literally puts a needle in my arm. And at 14, the summer of 1976, my oldest and best, my favorite brother, shot me up with cocaine. And I loved it. I thought it was I loved it. And he was my older brother. This guy, he was my idol, you know? And whatever he did and whatever he said, this must have been good. So the whole summer long, I ended up shooting up with cocaine. And I say that now, I don't want to freak people out with that story, but it really played a role in how far I've come and how I see my development, which I'll talk about in a minute. But I got into drugs. You know, my brother turned me on to drugs. And when he went back to college, I started doing LSD. I started doing more coke. I shot up more in the basement. I found a little, we had a bit, you know, there was a bathroom down there. So it was a sink. And I literally, in those years, I did a lot of drugs, believe it or not. 14, 15, 16 years old, I was doing drugs. And the reason why people drink or do drugs, we know this now in science, is because something in their childhood prevented them from developing something called self-love. Hmm. If we don't develop self-love at an early age, if we have downloaded negative emotions, if we've downloaded negative experiences, those things stay with us mm-hmm. forever until we reprogram those downloads.
Go in there for a second. I know what you mean with downloading, but can you explain that a little bit, what you mean by downloading negativity?
Sure. There's some new science out there called epigenetics. And epigenetics basically means that the experiences that your parents and their parents had growing up, and the experiences that you had at that early age, are in your genes. So people think of genetics as DNA, gets goes to the protein, and it's a one-way street. Well, it's not just a one-way street, because what also is in your genes is, for example, my mom was beat up as a child by her father. He was a brutal man. You know, he would slap her at the kitchen table in front of her kids, which I saw, which I downloaded, basically. So I saw, this is what I would call it as a download in those years from when you're in the third trimester, while you're in the womb of your mother until about the age of 6 or 7, growing up, everything we see and hear, we develop what's called paradigms for. And these paradigms basically are what you would call like a belief system. They start to develop our belief system. So if you saw your grandfather hit your mother at the kitchen table, you might think that's normal, that the man hits a woman. And my mom didn't say, stop it. My mom just said, oh, sorry. You might think it's normal. When you saw your father come home at 2 o'clock in the morning and he looked a little wobbly and he may have been holding a bottle in his hand, and suddenly he comes in and he starts yelling at your mother and you're 4 years old and you see this, you don't put it together that your dad might be drunk and your dad might have, you don't put that together at four. You just feel tension between your mom and dad. You downloaded tension between your mom and dad. You downloaded fear between your grandfather and your mother. So these negative downloads get so deep in your genes, and they sit there. They sit there and they create these paradigms, what I talked about. Now, this epigenetic story, so if you think about it, your parents had an upbringing, their parents had an upbringing, and all those negatives and positives, by the way, it's not just the negatives that stick in there, it's the positives as well. So all those things kind of stay with you. And when I talked about therapy, when I started therapy with stuff, I tried to kind of go back. This is what classical psychotherapy does. You go back into your childhood and try to recreate those experiences and how you felt and stuff like that. Therapy, I always say, is a wonderful thing for many people. They need to go back and deal with that stuff. But just going back and dealing with that stuff isn't enough. And we're going to talk about positive psychology in a minute. And this is the difference between classical psychotherapy and positive psychology. So anyway, so you download all these things. And as you grow up, those paradigms start to turn into habits. And the latest research is by the time you're 35 years old, between 90 and 95% of the things you say, feel, do, and think are so subconscious, you don't even know it. You're driving a car, you're not thinking about shifting those gears. You're brushing your teeth, you're not thinking of up, down, left, right, up, down, left, right. You're just doing it. And so now you're in a relationship, and this is where these negative so-called downloads and eventual habits come out is in relationships. So you're sitting at the kitchen table in a relationship, and in your relationship, and the idea of money comes up. Okay, you're in a relationship and you have to deal with money. Money, by the way, is one of the biggest issues, challenges, let's say, in a close relationship because of our downloads. And let me give you a perfect example. When I was growing up, my mom and dad, although they both worked, and although we were pretty, I would say, upper middle class people, they had a poor man mentality. they gave us the impression, we downloaded, all four boys downloaded, we didn't have enough. My mother would say, you know, turn the lights off in the bathroom, we're not Edison. Money doesn't grow on trees, which in fact it does, because trees are made of wood and money is paper and paper comes from wood. So actually money does grow on trees. Or starving children in Africa, eat everything on your plate. Well, those downloads, those are what we hear. And with those downloads, we create, and I created, not enough. Mm-hmm. There's not enough money. In my mind, not enough. Not enough money. And then, as I grew up, I put out into the universe, there's not enough. There's not enough money. And I can tell you, if it wasn't for my uncle and it wasn't for student loans up in, here and there and all the money that I made, I never had enough money. I was always in debt. I mean, I did it. My downloads, I welcome to the universe. Hi, universe. There's not enough money. And the universe says, yep, you're right. There's not enough money. So now, sitting at the kitchen table. So in a relationship, this is where these things come out. So I'm sitting at the kitchen table with my partner, Katya. And she basically, so I downloaded not enough. Now, Katya comes from a family where they had fruit and vegetable stores here in Aachen. And they had lots of money. They had it at the height of their business. They had four stores all around Herzogenrad, all around, you know, villages outside of Aachen and in Aachen. They were rolling in money. Matter of fact, Katya tells me they were millionaires in the 80s and 90s. One problem. They didn't know how to handle money. They didn't know what to do with money. So they didn't pay their taxes. They didn't pay their debtors. They didn't pay people. So what happened? What did Katya download? Money's great, but there's never enough of it. There's never enough. We're going to always be in debt. When you have a lot of money, it means debt. Money means debt. So now we're sitting at the kitchen table. Katya says to me, so Rand, you know, the electric bill went up 20 euros. So my download, without even thinking about it, because it's so subconscious, my download goes, do we have enough? I said to her, do we have enough? I mean, do we have enough? I mean, we have a good amount of money. But my download said, is there enough? Katya's download went, well, yeah, but with all our debts, we may not have enough because we have debt, because she downloaded the debt story. And suddenly, we're in our downloads and we get into an argument. We get into an argument about money. And I went like this. I went, whoa, 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 stop. And I realized, wait a minute. This is not us. This is not the story. We're not there. We've got enough. We are enough. And this is what downloads tend to do to people. They give them the impression or the feeling that they're not enough. They don't have enough money. So they're always chasing money. Okay. And when you chase money, this is called crying money. We call it crying money because it's crying. I'm running after me. You don't get it. But happy money is when you don't chase money. When you do what you love to do, you get happy money and you give happy money. Okay. Happy money has a different movement than crying money. Mm. Beautiful, relatively new book called Happy Money. I can highly recommend from a Japanese author, Happy Money. And it talks just about these things. He uses science to create, we create our vision with money, either happy or crying. So anyway, we download all these things. And the key is, somebody asked me, well, how do we change it? I mean, with all these subconscious downloads, how do we know what to change and how do we change it? So basically, there are probably three ways that you can reprogram. Number one, you have to know where it came from and what it is. I mean, because so this is where consciousness comes in, mindfulness comes in. And in my seminars and things, I teach mindfulness. And I don't mean sitting in a corner doing om for 5 hours with your legs crossed. I mean just being silencing the mind. And mindfulness, as many people who are in this know, it only means being in the moment with one thought, with no judgments. limit your thoughts to one, and very often it's breathing, with no judgments. Because we tend to judge. Good, bad, good, oh, that's not good. Oh, I'm ugly. Oh, that's not. We tend to give judgments, and judgments is a killer. Judgments is a killer because it means we're not enough. Judgments, judging other things, means we're not enough. Okay, we don't have enough love. So I always say three things to reprogram in the epigenetic story if you've downloaded some things. Number one, first you have to realize it. Number one, meditation. Going back into this mindful story and trying to realize what it is you need to deal with. And then think about a situation or two that you're in and the reactions you have, and try to react in a different way. And this is what I talk about mantras. And this goes into number two, is the time when we are most in our subconscious mind is directly before we fall asleep and directly before we wake up. So what I do is I fall asleep to mantras. I fall asleep to "you are enough, everything is great," or ohms. I fall asleep to beautiful, encouraging mantras. And I recorded them myself. I fall asleep to my own voice going, "Rand, you have it all. You are enough. You love yourself. You are beautiful, Rand. You're handsome. This is how you, so you fall asleep to those things. You wake up to those things. You know, I'm getting less and less because I'm pretty much there. I don't want to say there, but I love myself these days, and I don't. And part of that is I've changed my lifestyle. I don't drink anymore. I used to still be in the drugs even when I moved to Germany. Don't do anything that anymore. I do yoga. I meditate. I do sports. I'm a vegan. I literally have changed my life where everything that goes in it, everything that goes in my body, I chose.
Which is also like a sign of self-love to control that, because you only want the best for yourself and for your body and your mind.
Definitely. I mean, the Buddhists have been talking about this for thousands of years. The outside world did not affect your inside world unless it's positive. Unless it's, you're in the forest and you're looking at the green and you're feeling the wonderful breeze and you hear the birds singing. If it's a positive effect, if it's affecting you positive, let it happen. But negative energy from the outside world, negative people, downer, I call them downer people, stay away from them. Stay away from them. And the third thing is literally what I just said, hanging out with people that support you, that support the new mindset, that support the new download, that support the new loving Rand, the new part of you that loves yourself. You know, when I stopped drinking, December 23rd, 2016, I stopped drinking. And I'm not saying I was a big drinker, but I liked wine. I grew up in a restaurant family. I lived in Italy. Hey, I love wine. Hey.
I mean, no.
It goes as fine. I love wine. And but I stopped drinking basically, and I'm going to tell this story. The Germans out there that are listening, alcohol in Germany is a problem. America, we have pharma. We have the pharma industry that we've grew up with. We aspirin. My mom, you had your nail hurt. You had a little fingernail problem. Take an aspirin. We had literally a chest full of aspirin. So the pharma industry took over America. What took over Germany is the alcohol industry. And the lobbies don't talk about it. They don't really talk that it could be a problem. So children can drink here at 16. And it's nothing to go at 17, 18 years old to the park during the summer, 3 days a week with your friends, with a few cases of beer. That's like normal. Well, guess what? It isn't normal to go 2-3 times a week to the park with a few cases of beer. It's alcohol. It's not water. But see, the culture, and this is where epigenetics comes in, that you grow up with your parents drinking alcohol. You
downloaded that it's normal.
You downloaded that alcohol is like water because your neighbors drank it wherever you went. you're every party, you basically, one of the things I love about Germans is they help each other move. It's a moving story. But what comes after the move? What do you celebrate with?
Yeah.
Beer, pizza and beer. This is a story. So beer is like a celebration. What about celebrating with a smoothie? What about celebrating with something healthy? So this is what happened. So I quit drinking because I saw my daughter. She was about 20 years old at the time, living in the Frankenberger Viertel here. They would go to the park there, and they would, with the kiss of beer, with a case of beer, 3 times. And I couldn't tell my 20-year-old daughter, Ronnie, I think you think you're drinking too much, because it's the father talking. So what did I do? A parent as a role model. I quit drinking because she knows I like wine. So I quit. I wanted to see if that had an effect on her, and you can't believe it. 3.5 years later, my daughter is so conscious of her drinking now. It totally turned her around. She still drinks, but it made her conscious of what she's putting in her system. When we go out, we used to order a bottle of wine. Now we order a bottle of water when we're together. So I've made her conscious, and I think this is how we raise children.
And you're led by example. I think this is a core thing too.
And you know, you talked about the whole happiness at work story, and we're working towards that. Managers and leaders are role model. They're role models for their employees. What your boss says and does, what your leader says and does, what your supervisor says and does, and how he does it. How he reacts to problems, how he reacts to challenges, how he reacts to good things. The employees are watching this. The employees at a company are like children in a family. And that's it. The bosses are the parents, and the employees are the children. So we've got leaders and managers and supervisors, and anyone in charge has to be very careful about how they react. Are they proactive? Positively proactive, or are they negatively reactive? Because your people are watching. So anyway, I changed my life around with a lot of these things. And I grew up with alcohol. I mean, this is the other thing. I knew about drinking because I downloaded. Everybody was drinking in those years. This was the 50s, 60s, and 70s. 50s and 60s were mainly alcohol. 70s became into the drugstore with the hippies and the good food and all that stuff, the BO food. I mean, let me tell you, my brother brought back two things, cocaine for his younger brother and natural food. This is when I started vegetarianism. I mean, I started being a vegetarian at 14 years old, 1976. Today, it's a big trend, you know? And in 76, I was eating healthy, but I used it as a balancing act. I said, you know what? If I eat healthy, I can continue with the LSD. You know what I mean? This will just balance it out. You know, I was convincing myself that this was the route to take. So anyway, let me get back. So I and working for my uncle, was that enough? I'm sorry, on epigenetics?
Yeah. Yeah. I would like to get to the point where you changed also your vision on work and you came into positive psychology.
Right. So that's what I mean with the downloads. The download stories, it really starts there. To end that story, it starts with self-love. And did you download self-love? Were you taught as a child to love yourself? And I wasn't. I was beat by my mother. I was sexually abused by my uncle. I was emotionally abused by my teachers in school. I physically abused myself with needles in my arm. So I basically had to get rid of those stories. I didn't have self-love. And I'll tell you, I started to grow self-love. So after I finished college, my brother Bob was in, I worked a little in for my uncle's restaurant, but then I moved out to LA. 1988, I moved out to LA, landed on my brother's doorstep, said, Bob, I'm here to live with you. Well, it turned out my brother didn't get off the drugs at that point. This was now 1988. This was 12 years later, and he basically got into harder stuff. He was doing crack, and I saw him doing crack now. I was living in my brother's apartment, and one night, 3 o'clock in the morning, I hear my brother in the bathroom going, And I walk in there and he's literally on the floor in the bathroom, 3 o'clock in the morning, smoking crack. He looks up at me and goes, "Want some?" And I knew I had to get out of there because I was already weaning myself off the heavy drugs. I didn't want to go there. I ended up moving from LA up to Santa Cruz, California. And I started working up there. And then I got into something that really changed my life. I got into running, like marathon running. And I started training on the beach, on the ocean there, up in Santa Cruz, California. And I was in heaven. And then I started to do races. There was a race in San Francisco called the Beta Breakers. And I ran in this race and I kind of did pretty good. And then in 1989, July of 89, I read that there was going to be a Chicago Marathon in October. And I said to myself, I'm going to go back to Chicago, that's where I'm from, and go run in that marathon and visit the family. And I had a vision. So I said, I'm going to start my way back now. It was July, August, 1989. I got in my car, quit my job. I was working in a hospital at that time just to make some extra money. And I started back driving to Chicago. I ended up in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I had been there before. My brother invited me there for a drug excursion we had back in the early 80s. So I knew about Santa Fe, ended up in Santa Fe, beautiful place in the southwest of America. And I just loved it. I overnighted there and I used it as a training place because it's 7,000 feet, 2,500 meters above sea level. And if you're an athlete, training at high altitude is good for you because of oxygen. You have lower oxygen up there. And then when you are at sea level, you can run better, you can work out better. So I ended up training. I ended up going back to school there because I stayed there 2 weeks. I heard there was a university there. And I said, wait, I'll go back to school. Why not? Ended up going back to school, getting my master's degree, studied psychology, philosophy. And it was crazy. I didn't plan to go back to school, but I tended to be, okay, why not? And this goes into another something that I think that I've kind of always had that I could tell you the listeners can really use. There's something called fixed and growth mindsets. And this was basically some research done by a woman named Carol Dweck back in the 80s. And she basically came onto this fixed and growth mindset theory. She went into the American school system. She was an American psychologist, and she went into the American school systems, and she wanted to see if these children had a particular mindset already at an early age. Again, epigenetics, because your mindset comes from those early years very often, and genetics, not just epigenetics, but genetics. We could be more like our father because he thinks a certain way and we think that way, or our mother, she's more forgiving and so are we. I mean, genetics is 50% of who you are is genetic. So she went into the school systems and she would stand in front of a classroom. She did this with thousands of kids. And she said to the children, "Hello, my name is Carol Dweck. Your director of the school let me be here. And before we begin, we're going to take a test." This was the experiment. This was her research. She wanted to see when she gave somebody a challenge, we're going to take a test, what was their reaction? Some kids went, "Oh, I hate tests. I'm no good with tests. It's going to be awful." Fixed mindset. Some children, "Oh, I love tests. Boy, let's give it to me, you know.
Now I can show what I can do."
Up their sleeves. So she discovered something that there was in children at an early age, a fixed mindset, afraid to fail. Fixed mindset people compare themselves with people below them so they feel better. Growth mindset people love to fail because failing means they've learned something. How can I do it better next time? So fixed mindset people compare themselves with people above them to continually fail so that they can get up there. A different story. Me, I'm a growth mindset people. My mother taught me to be growth mindset. So I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico, school, college, go back to school. Yeah, why not? Okay, well, I ended up going back to school, trying a new challenge. I wasn't afraid. To be honest, education wasn't my thing, but I used it kind of as a way out of my. I realize now, looking back, I used education as another substitute as the way out of my neighborhood, of the abusive stuff in my neighborhood. And so anyway, went back to school, finished, got my master's degree, then finished that. After I finished my master's, again, I was reading a newspaper. I didn't know what to do. I was living in Santa Fe. I never went back, by the way, to Chicago to run in the Chicago Marathon.
Oh, okay.
I gave up running when I started my master's. I went on to something else. And I was reading the newspaper, and I saw in Albuquerque, New Mexico, an ad at the university there for a language arts teacher program. So basically an English teacher. People who have their degrees can become a language teacher, an English teacher, with a 14-month intensive. I applied. I got in. I went back to school. I went to the University of New Mexico, and I was waiting tables at a restaurant to make money. And my uncle was sending me money.
Again,
my uncle was helping me out. So I basically learned to be a teacher, an English teacher, another degree. See, in America, it's very different than other places. You do many things by the time you're a certain age. I mean, I was only 29 years old, and I did my bachelor's, I did my master's degree, and now I'm going to do another thing, and I'm 29. And I really hadn't really worked. I was only waiting tables by, you know, at this time. So I ended up going back to school, and in part of this teacher training, I had to team teach in a school in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So I was team teaching, and while I was teaching, I realized this is what I want to be for the rest of my life. I found what I want, to be a teacher. You know, earlier in this conversation, you called me a coach and a trainer and all these things. And we call ourselves those. But you know what? I call myself a teacher. Because teachers take information that they learn or they've done research on. They bring it in. They try it themselves very often, which I did. Did it work? You know, with my growth mindset, I'll try it. I failed here. Oh, this worked. Oh, this is great. Oh, this is great. I try it, and then I give it away. And then I create workshops and seminars to give it away, you see? So I take information, I work it through, and then I give it away. So I'm like a middleman for information.
But you enrich it with your experience and your own thing.
Well said. I enrich it with the things I learned in my childhood. I enrich it with the things I learned in my neighborhood. I enrich it with the things I learned in Italy in school. I enrich the things that I'm taking from science, and I give it away. That's what I do. And I hope people fly. I help people fly. And when they fly, I am very happy. It makes me so happy. And this is another sign of self-love. If you can't be happy for other people's happiness, you don't love yourself. There are so many people that are jealous of other people making it. There are so many people that have envy that this one has more money, has a new car, bought that new house. If you have any emotions that give you feelings of envy or jealousy, you have a self-love problem, period. So I love to watch people fly. So I know my self-love story is done. I'm there. I can look in the mirror and go, you are a good-looking kid, Ran. So I ended up, while I was team teaching and helping these children grow, I met a little girl whose mother I got really close to, and I started dating her. The mother, her husband, she wasn't married anymore, and the child was from obviously another man. And we started dating in 91, 92. In 1995, while I was still teaching her daughter, we had a child of our own. It wasn't a planned story, but it was a story. And I always say it was the best unplanned thing in my life. This is that same daughter who I basically quit drinking to hopefully find out she quit drinking. And then in 1999, the woman that I was with said she wanted to go back home because she wasn't from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and her home was Aachen. Mm-hmm. So in 1999 of August, so literally 20 years ago to this month, I moved to Aachen. A little timely, this is nice, this podcast comes on the anniversary, my 20th anniversary of moving to Aachen. I landed here and I didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't speak the language. So I was an English teacher back home. I studied psychology. I studied communications. I spoke Italian. I landed in Aachen. What am I going to do? So I ended up going to the Chamber of Commerce, the IECA, and I said, well, you know what? I'm going to get email addresses and business addresses of companies, and I'm going to teach them English because this is what I can do. I ended up getting about 3,000 actual addresses. I had to pay for them. Of companies, and I wrote personal letters. Hello, my name is Randall. I'm an English teacher from America. Don't you want me? From 3,000 letters I sent out, I got 6 responses. From 6 responses, 3 of those companies, 3 or 4 of those companies hired me. Linton Springley, Centis, Saint-Gobain, and Grunenthal. 4 companies in Aachen hired me to be their English teacher. This is how I got started in this whole thing. And this, we're coming to positive psychology now because this is where this whole thing started. I started teaching English at these 4 companies and I was on a roll. My students, I would go to the company 90 minutes a week and my students were great. We talked about everything. I taught them grammar. I taught them life skills. I was teaching, you know, I was taking what I learned before and adding my own experience. And I added my own experience of how I learned Italian to how to teach English. Oh, okay. And I gave it to them. And I got really popular because a lot of my students had husbands and wives that worked for other companies. And they told them about me. And I, as the years went on, and this was the year now, this was 2000. And the year went on, the 2000, 2001, I started to grow. I was growing. I had 12, 13 companies I was teaching English for. So around 2003, I would say, I was in one of my classes and I used to start out every class with something that I call highlights. They would have to tell me about highlights since the last week. And today we know this is gratitude. This is called gratefulness. But I didn't know it back then. This was back in the year 2000, 2001, 2002. I didn't know, you know. So they would start out with highlights. And I realized that their highlights were always about 3 things. Family, them, their personal, something that they did or that they did sports, something about them, or friends. So went on vacation with my family. Yes, I did my sports yesterday. I'm a member of the club. My friends and I went out to dinner last night, all these things. So one day, I remember it very clearly. The woman's name was Petra. She was a student of mine. I said to Petra, in a room with 8 people, I won't say the company. I said, Petra, give me a work highlight. Tell me something about work that you love. So Petra kind of very quietly looked around in the room and very quietly says, I hate my boss.
Oops.
I said, well, that's a little bit of a low light, not really a highlight. And I said, how many other people in the room hate their boss? And they're all like, I do. I do. I do. Their boss obviously wasn't in the room. Hmm. And I said to myself, wow. And the teacher in me kicked in. The teacher in me went, ning, 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 ding. Uh-oh. Gotta teach people not to hate their boss, you know. So I got home And I called my brother. Now, this time, 2003, my brother Bob, the one out, he was still living in L.A., but at this time, my brother had, he had gone through a trauma, a traumatic experience. He got arrested robbing a bakery, and he was in a rehab, quit drugs, got into yoga. And when I called him in 2003, my brother was a yoga star in L.A. He really got off the stuff. But he had to go to jail to do it. He went to jail for 4 months and then went to a rehab. And he had that process. He needed, and very often people need traumatic experiences to change their direction in their life. And this is what he needed. Obviously, everyone doesn't need that, but some people do. So I called my brother Bob, who was still my hero. I said, Bob, in Germany, is there anything in America right now that I could use other than yoga? I you know, yoga is still a little weird here. This is 2003. Yoga was still something from the East or something they did in America. Today, you know, every third, fourth, fifth person's doing yoga in Germany. But this was back then. And my brother Bob said, yeah, Rand, there's a new psychology, a new science called positive psychology. And it's relatively new, started about 5 years ago out of the University of Pennsylvania, a guy named Martin Seligman. And he says, take a look at it. You may find it interesting. So I went out, went online, bought a book, read it, Martin Seligman's book, is one of his first books called Learned Helplessness. And science, packed with science on how we learn to be helpless. And I remember reading this book, and there was one experiment that they did, and this is not nice to say, but they did it on rats. I know today it's, animal cruelty is I'm totally against being a vegan. But these were the old years when they did these experiments, and they learned a lot of things. I don't support it now, but the science of this is more important, that they would have rats in a cage, and what they would do is they would reward them if they did a certain thing, yeah, and they would get a reward with some candy or something really special. Like they would reward them like a reward, mm-hmm. And then what they started doing was not rewarding them with candy, they would shock them.
So they would punish them.
They would punish them instead of rewarding them.
Yes.
Even though they would give them they would basically teach them that it doesn't matter what you do, you're still going to get shocked. And he started to realize that we have this in us, learned helplessness. We learn to be helpless because we constantly get negativity and we don't try things anymore. We don't try things anymore because we're going to feel like we're going to fail.
So we just give up, basically.
We give up. So what he saw was that rats were giving up jumping over things because they just said it didn't matter. I'm going to get punished anyway. It didn't matter, basically. Mm. So he wrote this book called Learned Helplessness, and I read it and I said, wow, I'm going to start to create things out of this. I'm going to use this science and start to create workshops and seminars. And I'm going to offer it to the 12 or so companies that I'm already teaching English to, you know? So I started doing that. It turns out it started to grow this way. And then I called, I wanted to get more into positive psychology. I literally called the University of Pennsylvania. I wanted to talk to Martin Seligman. Coincidentally, Seligman wasn't there, but he was in Europe, traveling Europe. He was in, of all places, Rosenheim. South of Munich at a positive psychology conference. So I literally called him up, got a ticket, went down there and spent the weekend. I mean, it happened really quick. I spent the weekend with Martin Seligman, the guy who created positive psychology. And he did talks, and there were 200 people in the room, most of them psychologists, coaches, doctors, teachers, professionals learning about this relatively new science that nobody really ever heard of. Today, it's more on the map in Germany, but those years it wasn't. So I remember it was a Saturday night. It was a weekend. It was a weekend seminar story, conference. It was a weekend conference. Saturday night, everybody went to the restaurant. It was at this hotel. And I walk into the restaurant, and there's Martin Seligman, the founder of positive psychology, sitting at a table all alone. Everybody around him eating, Martin Seligman sitting all alone. Went up to him, Mr. Seligman, Professor Seligman, can I sit here? Oh, yeah, sure. Nobody sits here. I don't know. Ended up sitting with him, ending up having one of the most beautiful conversations with Martin. And he said, call me Marty. I said, okay, Marty. He's got seven children. He puts most of his money into research. He's more like of a researcher. Used to be the president of the American Psychological Association. Really a interesting man. And to this day, I'm still friends with Marty. I email him, where are you going to be? I'm coming to America. Can I come visit? He says, I'm coming to Europe. Come on down. I'll be here. To this day, we have a real personal connection, which I'm kind of proud of. So anyway, that conference, I came back from that conference, and I started getting more and more into this, what the science of positive psychology. And then years later, this was then about 7-8 years ago, I decided to go for my PhD and asked Marty, is there anywhere he would recommend me getting my PhD? And he said, well, in Rotterdam at Erasmus University, they have an institute that studies happiness. So being the growth mindset guy, I get on the phone, I call up the university. Hi, can I speak to the person in charge of the Happiness Institute there? Yeah, that would be Ruth Veenhoven. Hold on a minute. Connect, literally, like, get on the phone. Hi, Ruth Veenhoven here. How can I help you? Yeah, Ruth, Martin Seligman sent me. Oh, Marty, how's he doing? Great. Ruth, listen, I want to get my PhD. Can I come up and talk about it? Sure. Next week, went up to the university, went to their cafeteria, sat there with Ruth Veenhoven, a beautiful man. He said to me, so what do you want to study? He said, do you know how PhDs work? I said, no, not really. No, don't really know how that really works. He goes, well, there's two options in the Netherlands. You either write a book or you do four papers, research papers, that can be published. Two, and you have to have four published research papers. So write a book or do four published. And the book story for me at that time was just like, whoa, writing a book, nah. So I said, I'll take option B. I'll take door number two, I told him. He said, okay, do you have an idea of what you would do your papers on? I go, well, I don't know. You know, I'm living in Germany, and I'm sure there's a lot of Americans there. And maybe I can study happiness, Americans' happiness in Germany. He looks up into the sky, and he looks up and he says, He says, we don't have that in our database of studies. I said, well, is that a good sign? He goes, that's a good sign. Yeah, that's a good sign. We don't have that study. I said, okay, I'll take it. I will study American happiness, U.S. citizens living in Germany, and their happiness. And he says to me, okay, you want to do your four papers? He says, I'll tell you what. He says, you do your first paper. He says, and then we'll talk about if you can be part of the institution. I want to see what you got. I said, Root, it ain't going to work that way. I says, I'm an all or nothing in kind of guy. I says, either I'm an external graduate student, external PhD candidate for your university, period, or I can't do this. He thought about it. He goes, okay. He says, I like you. He says, I like you. I'll give it to you. Four research papers. You defend it. You got your PhD. I said, I put up my hand. I said, a handshake? Handshake. So we shook on it. Since then, it's basically, I'm still on it. I've got Americans. I created a survey. I ended up hooking up with a guy at the university there, another guy who he's basically my dissertation partner. And I've got Americans now filling out my survey, my papers. I will probably have all the data by the end of this year to finish this thing, to start writing those papers. And if all goes well, I'll have my literally my PhD at the end of this year. And you can still call me Randall, Lillian. You know, you don't have to call me
what
Dr.
an honor.
Or you can call me Dr. Happy. So while I've been at the school up there as an external PhD candidate, I've been literally doing. I have to look at science. See, I'm collecting data from my Americans, but at the same time, I need to know what are the variables for happiness, because I have to use the research that I find to support my theories and my data. This is how research works. You support your data with other people's data and research. So that's how you do your PhD. For anybody who's wanting to know how you do, how you get a PhD in a master's thesis. If you do a thesis and you come out and you say, and you make a hypothesis, they're called, you have to support your hypothesis with data and other people's research supporting your hypothesis. So since I've been doing this, I'm telling you, I know all the things about happiness and what happiness really means. I've basically ended teaching, and I started more and more, and now totally, except for one company that I still work at from those original four companies, Linton Springley. So at Linton Springley here in Aachen, I've gone from English teacher to, I taught in the early years, then emotional intelligence, because I got into happiness. I saw that there was this positive psychology was connected to emotional intelligence, and I started learning emotional intelligence, created workshops, offered it to their management back in the early years. This was 15 years ago, emotional intelligence. And then I more or less went into this positive psychology, and then veered over to using epigenetics. Now, in my workshops and seminars and talks at companies, I have a toolbox of things. First off, I use my experience growing up where I grew up. I use my education, communication. I actually learned to be a communicator. I have a bachelor's degree in intercultural communications. I use my psychology background, learning psychology and studying psychology. And one other thing I didn't mention is during this time when I was reading about positive psychology and getting to know Martin Seligman, I got to know that in Oregon, a gentleman named Robert Biswas Diener, who I actually met near Munich there for that conference, he was also doing a stage, he offered something called positive psychology coaching. And it's basically an online course where he teaches you all about positive psychology, what it is, and how you can coach it, and how you could literally use it in your teachings. So I ended up during that time also, there was a 6-month period where I took a positive psychology coaching coach, and I have a certificate as a positive psychology coach and positive psychology trainer. In the meantime, they're actually offering master's degrees in positive psychology. University of East London has an MAPP, Masters in Applied Positive Psychology.
Seriously?
Yeah. University of London, if anybody's interested, and also at the University of Pennsylvania, an MAPP degree in Master's in Positive Psychology. So it's really on the map these days. Anyway, so what I do is I work in very different levels. I work at one-on-ones. Now, I tell people I'm not a therapist, and if somebody comes up to me and I feel that they need therapy, I will recommend therapy, and I will not work with someone if they need therapy, unless they're in therapy. If they're in therapy, I'll work with them. If I feel they need therapy and they don't want to go to therapy, I won't work with them, because I don't want to, I'm not a therapist. I don't want to do, well, so well, how did your father talk to you? What did your mom say when she, I don't want to go back. I want to go back there to discover things so we can use them to grow. I don't want to go back there and discover things so you learn to forgive your mother. You know what I mean? I don't, that's not my profession, right? So I go back there, figure out where it came from, and figure out how we can help it today for tomorrow.
How to transform it into something that brings them forward.
to reprogram it, basically. Okay. At the end of the day, I try to reprogram what they got. But you got to figure out where it came from. So I work one-on-one coachings. I work with private people here in Aachen. I'm at the Aachen Zeitung. I've been there for 3 years, where they organize seminars for me. I've got four coming up in November and one in December at the Aachen Zeitung. You can look up. It's Horizon Wissen I work for. So I work for privates. I work for companies where I go in and teach management elements of positive psychology. And finally, I work at the RVTH. I lecture positive education, which is very relatively new in Germany. It's called Schulfachglück, started in Berlin. And I do bits and pieces of Schulfachglück, which originated from positive psychology. So I have these four areas where I do. I'm gravitating more and more to the one-on-ones because I'm literally watching people transform their lives, and that makes me feel good. When I'm doing speeches in the public, I may have 200, 300 people, and they may have an aha moment there in those groups. But at the end of the day, I mean, I love it, but at the end of the day, 95% of those people are not going to change anything in their life. They're going to go back and they'll feel good for one or two or three days because they're on a high. And most people who have been to seminars and workshops for 1, 2, 3, and 5 days, they're on a high because they're with people that are like-minded and they're doing what they need to do. And for the week after they get home, they're feeling great. But 2 weeks later, they're falling.
Forgotten. Yeah.
Because of those downloads, they fall back into their old patterns. Mm. And you really, I can't stress this enough. If you fall back into your old patterns, and this is what generally people do, it's the slowest way to happiness. The quickest way to happiness is discover what those patterns are that are not making you happy. They're giving you negative emotions. This is where I can tell people, if you do something or think something, because it all starts in the mind. People always say, oh, I had a gut feeling, Bauchgefühl. There is no gut feeling. It started here. It's so subconscious, though, you didn't think about it. You
didn't realize it was coming from your mind.
Exactly. You didn't realize it because it was so in there.
Yeah.
Gut feelings come from here. Your reality, your mind, your thoughts create reality, period. So you have to get to your thoughts to change what you want in your life.
And you have to learn to observe the thoughts in the first place in order to change them.
Exactly. And this is where mindfulness comes in. This is where meditation comes in. This is where being in the moment comes in. So these people walk away and they're fine, but then it ends. You know, they don't really learn. So although I love that, I really am starting more and more to love the one-on-ones. The companies, what I really learned is, and it's crazy because since I started teaching English in Germany and then started doing my workshops here in Germany, they've been in German. I've been doing them in German. I never really thought of doing company things in English. I know that sounds crazy, but I started out doing them in German. So one day Katia came up to me and she said, why don't you start doing them in English and doing them in a more international setting? And I said, oh yeah, I speak English, don't I? But I generally, when I'm in companies, I just thought to speak German because I found that that speaking the language of the culture, people will hear it better than speaking another language. If they hear it in their own language, and this is also science, if we hear tragedy in our own language, it affects us more than hearing about tragedy in another language.
Mm, I can imagine.
Because we identify with that language. So I thought to have them identify with what I was saying that I would speak, do it in German. So once I started doing things in English, I started basically growing internationally. In October, I'll be in little advertising here. In October, I'll be in Utrecht doing a talk at a positive psychology conference. In December, I'll be in London for a week doing two seminars there in English, London. Excellent. And just on the 6th, 2 days ago, 6th of August, I was at the Brunsum Police Department in Brunsum giving a seminar to police officers in English. And I really realized that the language, our native tongue, our father, our mother tongue, is a wonderful story. Matter of fact, there's a speakers organization or website or platform called Gedankentanken, and they're based in Cologne, and they normally do things in German. It's a German speakers academy and things. And on the 23rd of this month, August 23rd, they're doing the first ever English speakers night.
Oh, really? I didn't know about that.
And they invited me there.
Really? So, wow, yeah, that's awesome.
I'll be on the stage at Gedankentanken. I'm kind of proud of that because the Stefan Frederick, the guy who runs it, he's from Aachen. And I met him.
No, really?
I met him years ago when he was first starting out, and I actually... I did work for him. He had something called the Gedankentanken Lounge on Brüsselstraße in Cologne, and I would give talks there when he was just starting out. So we have a friendship that is before Gedankentanken, and he never did anything in English, and now he's doing something in English, and he invited me to it, and I'm so proud to be there. So if anybody's in Cologne on the 23rd of August, tickets are going quick. I'll be at Gedankentanken. 23rd of August. So what I realized in all these stories that I'm telling you, maybe I can come to some kind of wrap up if I don't know how I can. We're us Americans, we go on forever.
I'm realizing that. And it's interesting because you kind of answered my last question already, which is where do we find you? Where can we see you? Which is okay. Nice. So we can actually wrap it up now.
We can wrap it up.
Yeah.
I would say, I will be, I'm all over the place, right? I'm doing kinds of things.
Omnipresent.
Omnipresent. One other thing is, if you do a little where am I going to be and a little advertising here, is I wrote a book. And my book in English is called Awfully Happy. You can get it on Amazon. Or in German, it's called Ekelhaft gut gelaunt. And basically the book... is about many of the things I talked about here. It's about my childhood growing up in a relatively abusive atmosphere. I mean, there were beautiful things in my childhood, and that's what the book's about. So the book talks about the abuse, but then does something in psychology called reframing. I reframed the abuse and made it, what did I learn positive out of those so-called negative experiences? For example, my mother, she was a good giving person. I learned to be a giver from my mother. Even though she was hitting me, she was giving me hits. But I learned she was to be a giver, giving to the garbage men, giving
generous.
Generousness. I learned generosity from my mother, various things. And so the book has three parts, is the not so good things I learned, the good things that I learned, and then a little bit of a self-help book. It helps people go back into their childhood and look at the wonderful things that happened in their childhood that they could use today. Because at the end of the day, Lillian, and I'm going to say this, and this might be a nice place to stop. At the end of the day, it begins with self-love. And if you judge, compare, or have any negative emotions throughout your day, it's probably inevitable that there's a self-love issue going on in there. And you, and only you, the person, you can come to my seminars and you can read my book and you can do it. But at the end of the day, happiness is a choice, yours. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, that is so true. And I'm so grateful you made the bridge to the self-love topic in the end, because this is like one of the main parts of my work too, as you know. So I'm so grateful for that. And thank you so much for your, for sharing your story and for sharing so much valuable information with us. And I think it was a great hour that we spent together. And I will put all the information and the link to your website and stuff like that in the show notes so people can get informed and to catch up with you if they want to.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I mean, it's people like you that help people like me work in their passion. I mean, your passion basically is also doing what I do. I've seen what you do, and I think it's a wonderful thing. I think your focus is more with women. Is that true?
No, not really. But for the self-love issue, maybe, yeah. But
self-love, it's interesting. That self-love story in my workshops, I see it more women heavy, we say, self-love story. And that's a historical story.
I know.
Women have been downtrodden for centuries and have always been second. And they've always tried to show themselves and prove themselves and all that. And I always tell women, and everybody for that matter, but even just the other day, I told her, this woman had some negative thoughts. And I said, I want you to repeat a mantra. And this is a mantra that I think all the people out there listening should repeat. Whenever they start comparing, whenever they start judging, whenever they start feeling bad or wrong or have to justify something, the mantra goes like this. I am enough. I am enough. I am enough.
Yeah.
Because you are enough.
Everybody is by nature.
Everybody is. You got what you need. You need to tailor make it a little bit. You need to go back and to go for. I always say sometimes you got to go back to go forward. All the time you have to go in to go out. And it's your choice.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Lily, for having me. I really appreciate you being there.
Thank you. And thank you for your time.
My pleasure. We'll talk again.
Yes, for sure.